motherfucker. Roll your damn window down. I'm somewhere outside of Barstow, on the edge of the desert, and the drugs begin to take hold. Take in this cool desert breeze. We're crossing the Mojave, brother, on our way back to Arkansas in the Hog State. After a wonderful weekend, I missed your call this morning. My phone was dead, and I was having breakfast with Lee Spiegel and his lovely girlfriend, Lorraine, about 130 miles to the border of California and Arizona. We looking across the high desert and purple mountains and cactus and rocks and scrub brush. I'll give you a call back when I got service because it's in and out across this desert. Yeah, Jamie's supposed to produce you tonight, so I'll check my message. You may have left a message. I don't know if you did or not. I'll go check while I've got service. But you can try to call me back, or I'll call you back as soon as I got more bars. Roll your damn window down.
Well, then, it's going to be one of those nights. Fantastic. Hubs.
Geronimo.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Gremium Report with your host, Mike Evans.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma and the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Gralian bunker. Once again, welcome to the Gralian Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, as we broadcast around the globe, worldwide, via that enigmatic modality known as the KGRA Radio Network. Here from the dark heart of the Appalachian Hills, as you know, autumn is upon us, and we're living it up. But before we get into the spirit of the autumn season, we're going to be looking at things that are happening in another location that happens to have a little fall color, red specifically. That's right, the red planet. Big news today, courtesy of our fine folks up there at NASA. We'll also be looking at some space-time mysteries, as well as some eerie developments occurring on Vancouver Island, which, according to some, point to an age-old legend about that location, which really spreads to all parts of the Pacific Northwest. We're going to be looking at those legends and what the possible folkloric, cultural, and maybe even real-world interpretations can be derived from those traditions in the second hour of tonight's program. But as we're kicking things off again, the big news that has been on everyone's mind over the weekend, even though a lot of press agencies had essentially figured out what was going to be happening, as we'll discuss in a moment, today nonetheless marked a turning point in the history of space exploration.
For 4 years, the scientific community has been unable to explain the waxing and waning of these dark streaks on the surface that form in late spring, grow through the summer, and then disappear by fall. During this time, additional observations have narrowed the constraints for how RSL might form, but there have been no evidence for water until now.
That's right. The new information presented today at the press conference held in Washington, D.C., is the best evidence we have seen to date for liquid water on the red planet. Now, granted, it's a briny water, a very salty liquid, but researchers said earlier today that this holds sincere implications for future expeditions on the red planet and, of course, as we're going to discuss in depth here in a moment, the potential for life existing on Mars. But what would you think if I told you that researchers believe that life is already there? We'll get into that in a moment. Now, this was according to John Grunsfeld earlier today. Our quest, he said, on Mars has been to follow the water in our search for life in the universe. And now we have convincing science that validates what we've been suspecting all along. Grunsfeld, of course, is an associate administrator at NASA's Science Mission Directorate in Washington, D.C., where earlier today that press conference was held. It's a significant development, Grunsfeld said, as it appears to confirm that water, albeit this briny form, is flowing today on the surface of Mars. Now, of course, how they were able to determine this is that they were examining these strange dark streaks, which have been observed really for years now, thanks to the use of the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. It's been circling the red planet since 2006, investigating these streaks, which technically are actually described as recurring slope lineae, or RSL. So if you hear that in some of the audio sound bites we're going to be revisiting earlier, that's what they're referring to. Recurring slope lineae, or RSL, are just these streaks that have been shown. And there was a brilliant animation that was featured at the Daily Mail shortly after the press conference that shows a time lapse over time throughout the seasons on Mars, where you can see as the warmer weather months occur that these lines darken. I mean, it's obvious. And so it was suspected that there was possibly water on Mars. The researchers, primarily from Georgia Tech, they were led by a doctoral candidate who phoned in earlier today from France, Luyendra Oha. We're going to call him Louis for the duration of the program, though, because that's a bit of a tongue twister, that name. They used science tools aboard the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter to monitor the seasons, and noted that, of course, these apparent liquid streams or these darkened paths that appear do seem to recede or disappear when temperatures on Mars get colder. The evidence before us suggests that these streaks are formed by salty water that comes and goes with the Martian seasons. And essentially what we're talking about is that we've got varieties of chemical components there in the soil that are hydrated. They contain water molecules. You know, a simple experiment you can do in your kitchen is you can take something like magnesium sulfate that you buy, in other words, Epsom salts that you would buy in the drugstore. And if you put those in a small crucible or a ceramic pot that can withstand warm temperatures and you bake those on high heat for a few minutes, what you will find is that those naturally clear magnesium sulfate crystals will turn a solid, powdery-looking white color. And what you're doing when you're baking those is you're actually producing a chemical process, in essence, where the hydrated forms of the magnesium sulfate actually take on an anhydrous, as it's referred to by chemists, state. You're essentially baking off the water. What we've got in the Martian soil is water that is appended to other molecules in this form, and which, of course, you know, maintains varying states of stability. You'll see in other things like, for instance, copper sulfate pentahydrate. You can buy that. It's usually root killer that you buy in the stores. And you can do the same thing with the copper sulfate pentahydrate. You bake off the water and it turns from that crystalline, you know, watery-looking blue color to a solid white. But if you leave it out and expose it to moisture over time, it will, of course, rehydrate because that's the most stable form, the pentahydrate, which includes five water molecules attached to each copper sulfate molecule. Now, granted, I'm no chemistry, and so we'll end the lecture here. But the point is that, you know, it's important to understand the chemistry in the soil there on Mars in order to understand what we're looking at. And it's taken a number of years, again, since 2006 when the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter went up. And we've been observing the soil, and after all this time, again, this is how the press was able to determine prior to the announcement what was happening, because it had already been announced. And it's been known for years that they suspected water, and at times throughout the year, liquid water was present, you know, on the Martian surface. The thing is that what the press was able to do is they were able to look at what had already been announced, including those who would be participating in today's press release. And some of those researchers, three of them, I believe, in fact, had been involved in a paper that is yet to be released, as I understand, but I think will be forthcoming in October, which discusses the new findings and the confirmation of the water on Mars. So we kind of knew what was going to happen. But during the press conference, which annoyingly, here in the Graylian bunker, my internet cut out just prior to, and I managed to, as a last-minute effort, resort to my smartphone to be able to get an access to the feed and listen to the entire press conference. I missed like the first 2 or 3 minutes. But, you know, they start off with a lot of hellos, you know, and greetings and all this stuff and introductions and everything. So by the time I tuned in, everything was already underway. And it was a good 45-50 minute long press conference. But distilled down to its finest essence, we've got some highlights here that we're going to look at, which include what I considered as it relates to the search for alien life. One thing that I would personally consider a bombshell, and then at least a couple of other points that are certainly very interesting and worthy of discussion. First of all, to kind of go over what this all means, Louis gave us via phone from France an overview of how this information was gathered, first and foremost, and also a bit about what the implications of this new information may be for the future of space travel.
It is truly an honor to be addressing this crowd about our results and discovery. As Alfred mentioned, we have been investigating these narrow streaks on Mars ever since their discovery, mainly to elucidate their formation mechanism. We know from prior investigations that these features form on Mars once temperature condition is ideal for liquid water to exist on the surface. However, as Alfred mentioned, a key evidence was missing until now, and that was their chemical identity.
Now, since we've kind of already touched on the chemistry as it relates to all this, we'll spare those details for now. I want to move on to the discussion of actual life on Mars. What has long been held by researchers is that perhaps below the surface layer, we're more likely to find life on the red planet. This new study, one of the primary implications is that with the water closer to the surface level, it makes it more likely that we may find life there just as well.
Our results may point to more habitable conditions on the near surface of Mars than previously thought. Here, potential habitability by Earth-like microbes is unclear. To assess habitability, we would first need to determine how cold and how concentrated the brine is. But the detection that we've described warrants further astrobiological characterization and exploration of these unique regions on Mars. Finally, water may be an important resource for future human explorers and inhabitants of Mars, and may decrease the cost and increase the resilience of human activity on the red planet.
Reporter Chip Reed with CBS was among those there covering this, and he asked, of course, he was the first question, which was the most obvious question on people's minds. So what are we talking about in terms of whether or not life exists? Are we really any closer to finding alien life? Because that's what this really all has to do with. Whether or not you're one of the many who believes that alien life has already visited Earth, we have to remember that scientific institutions do not accept that viewpoint. And even I, after studying UFOs personally for years and years and years, I think that there's something to be said for UAP or unexplained aerial phenomena. But in my mind, none of that points to good evidence for extraterrestrial visitation to Earth. And consider this for a moment. If we prove that life exists out there, that could be the stepping stone. I always say if we want to really make progress scientifically, we're going to have to take baby steps. And so maybe the initial discovery, the irrefutable proof of life on planets other than Earth, will be that first in a series of steps toward understanding the broader question about, are we alone in the universe? And if not, are there things in our midst that could possibly represent that broader notion of contact? Whether or not that's the case, you know, I want to just frame what we're looking at here within that context, because I realize a lot of people, especially in this listening audience, have questions about that. I mean, I'm contacted by people every day who say, hey, you know, I've seen something strange. This was so strange. I mean, this is not some kind of a technology that can be easily accounted for within the scope of known human technologies. And so it's completely understandable that people look at UFO phenomena and say, hey, there's something more going on here. We don't have all the answers. I'm not telling you that I have all the answers. I certainly don't. But I do want to try and underscore the importance of the scientific approach towards studying alien life. At some point, we'll no doubt bridge the gap. We'll be able to answer a lot of questions about things that we see in the world around us. But right now, as it applies to the scientific method and its application to the search for alien life, this is, without question, the closest we have probably come. And that's truly groundbreaking. So as I mentioned, Chip Reed of CBS was the first among the press to be called upon. And of course, he asks the big question. What do we know about life on Mars?
How likely do you think it is, a 1 to 10 point scale or whatever you choose, that today there is some form of life on Mars?
Okay, I guess everybody's looking at me. So I'll give you my feeling. You know, when you look at Earth, water is an essential ingredient. And just about, well, not just about, everywhere we go where there's liquid water, whether it's deep in the Earth or in the arid regions, we find life. This is tremendously exciting. We haven't been able to answer the question, does life exist beyond Earth? But following the water is critical element of that. We now have, I think, great opportunities to be in the right locations on Mars to thoroughly investigate that. And I think the reoccurring slope lineae with the actual water on the surface allows us with surface mobility that we have in our assets now and in the future, to be able to go over to thoroughly investigate that and indeed look for life and then make that positive identification.
Our view of Mars, of this ancient Mars and the possibility of, you know, life originating on Mars, has been really about seeking chemical fossils of possible past life on Mars. The existence of liquid water, even if it's super salty, briny water, gives the possibility that if there's life on Mars, you know, that we have a way to describe how it might survive. And that we are now at a point, technologically, with, you know, over 50 years of successful spaceflight, that we have the capability to go there, ask this question of is there life on Mars, and answer it. You know, this is, to me, the most exciting thing, is now that question is not an abstract scientific question. It's a concrete one that we can answer.
Michael?
Yeah, I would just like to add sort of a sensibility about how much we don't know. We have only one example of life, and that's us. This is it, on planet Earth. We don't know how it started. And so one of the things that we found at Mars is we know that Mars could have supported life, at least what we know about life. But we don't know how life started here, so we don't know if it's possible for life to have started on Mars. And so that's a huge question that needs further exploration. And it's only through that exploration that we're going to narrow the possibilities down and maybe get actually a direct answer.
So I'm just going to just expand a little bit on that. You know, now that we know what we're looking for, with high rise, we can begin a better search. We can begin to be more methodical. We can look and see if we can determine if there is some sort of aquifer network that may be supplying these. We don't know that. There are other theories, other ideas, but that is actually the next step. How much water that, when it left the planet, went into the soil, went underground. And that, as we said, is also a resource for human exploration for us. So if there is indeed those kind of resources that we can begin to probe, we might be able to answer that question pretty quickly.
So there are multiple benefits we find here. Not only is there a greater potential, as we have already examined, that life exists there on Mars, but the resources available are going to be of benefit to future human colonies that arrive there. And really, it may not be until we get to Mars that we will be able to conclusively determine whether life exists there. And as we'll look at a little later, we've got to be really careful about when we eventually go to Mars, while we're searching for life on Mars, we've got to be careful that what we find isn't something we already sent up there. We'll get to that in just a moment, but first, I want to return to this idea that the life that exists on Mars, in likelihood, has been believed to exist below the surface.
I would just say that I think the possibility of life in the interior of Mars has always been very high. There's certainly water somewhere in the crust of Mars. And Mars has received meteorites from Earth. It's been contaminated by Earth rocks, and we know that microbes can survive that trip. So it's very likely, I think, that there's life somewhere in the crust of Mars, microbes. But it's, where is it? How accessible is it? It's very difficult now. Maybe there's something we can find close to the surface, and that's what's exciting. But to me, the chances of there being life in the subsurface of Mars has always been very high.
And while they say that possibility has always been fairly high, this is what really fascinated me. Okay, the idea that there is already life on Mars, this is precisely what one of the researchers there present at the press conference had said. But it may not be the kind of life you're thinking, or at very least the kind that we've long hoped for.
The question of, is there life on Mars? We know there's life on Mars already because we sent it there. We try and clean our spacecraft as best as we can. And the Vikings certainly were sterilized the best of any of our spacecraft because we just didn't know. But the surface of Mars is really a very harsh place. It's got ultraviolet light from the sun that bakes the outside of the spacecraft. And if you want to kill microbes on Earth, you take a UV light and you kill the microbes. We've cleaned the spacecraft as best as we can, but we know that, you know, microbial life, bacteria, are so tenacious that it's impossible to kill them all. So we do the best job we can, and then we send our spacecraft into areas that we think are the least sensitive to the possibility of contaminating extant Mars life. And so what Ken Chang of the New York Times has suggested is, how can we take a spacecraft like Curiosity that may not have been cleaned as well as, say, Viking, to an area that might have extant life? And it's a great question. But this is the scientific process. This is why, you know, we're, you know, crawling before we walk, so to speak, that we're being very careful that we don't send a spacecraft to Mars with the intention of detecting Martian life and find out that we detected the Earth life we took with us. And this is the general, well, I mean, it's, you know, that's true. Tough to do. Yeah. When you actually go down and list, you know, how do you avoid doing that? It's very hard. And this is the general field that you may hear us talk about, it, of planetary protection. It's not only protecting the Earth from bringing some alien life form to Earth, but more so right now, it's protecting the environments that we go to, whether it's Mars or Europa, to make sure, you know, that we don't contaminate other planets before we find out if we're alone in the universe.
Those statements were among the most interesting that were made throughout the course of the entire press conference, in my opinion. Because not only are we saying, hey, you know what? No matter how hard we have tried to effectively sterilize what we send to the red planet, there's no way we can prevent the transfer of certain microbial life. We already know there's life on Mars. We sent it there. And in addition to that, it raises the further question about whether, when we send things to Mars, we will, A, contaminate that environment, or B, if we bring anything back from Mars, whether we could potentially contaminate Earth with Martian microbes. Yeah, if this is starting to sound a little bit like War of the Worlds to you, well, you're not alone. In fact, this reminds me so much of that famous radio broadcast of yesteryear based on H.G. Wells' novel, that we'll revisit that a little when we come back from the next break. But before we wrap up our segment about this press conference, the implications of the discovery of flowing water on Mars, and also what that means for the search for extraterrestrial life, first I'd like to wrap up this segment with a few kind of funny anecdotes that appeared throughout the conference, including one which, as I've already kind of touched on, compares this current space exploration mission to that of what we see in science fiction.
I think it's important to realize that NASA's approach to exploration is not Star Trek. It's not go where no man has gone before, as they say. It's really a very methodical approach for which we learn everything about the environment that we're going to subject humans to that we possibly can.
And finally, apart from the discussion of alien life, really, with all that water on Mars, what exactly do these researchers really plan to do with it?
So you found water. What are the next steps? What do you plan to do with this information?
Drink it.
Drink it.
Well, yeah, let's do that.
Ah, well said. You know, before long, there's going to be a new chemical cocktail that's going to be made solely of Martian topsoil, which we'll be enjoying there on the Martian colonies. Let's hope it has enough kick without having to have microbes behind it, huh? So that's going to wrap up the Mars segment. But when we come back, I want to look back in the past at some of the fury and the frenzy that arose around that famous broadcast where Martians purportedly came to Earth. We'll look at that when we return here on the Graylian Report. Dark Hills of Appalachia, I'm Micah Hanks. Welcome back to the program. As we've just seen in this last segment, of course, we've been looking at the implications of the news that was just released earlier today in Washington, D.C. Yes, indeed, in our search for extraterrestrial life, we may have come one step closer. And, of course, the implications of finding water, confirming that there's flowing water on Mars. This, of course, has implications not only for alien life that may exist, but also for future colonies that arrive on the red planet. I do plan to go see this new film with Matt Damon, The Martian. It's not the kind of film that generally I'm attracted to go see. You'd think I would want to go see films like that. I don't know. It's terrible. Red Pill Junkie's going to probably try and wring my neck when he finally does see me. I still have not even seen Interstellar. What is wrong with me? Well, I mean, I guess part of it is really that, you know, I seldom have the time to set aside to go and watch television. I don't own a TV. You know, I do Netflix, and I love going and seeing movies, but I guess I'm very selective about the films I do go see. In fact, I think maybe the last film I went to the theaters to actually go see was Mr. Holmes. That premiered here in Asheville. At first, I was laughing because I was the only guy in the theater. And I mean, 2 minutes before the thing starts, everybody just crowds in. And I was actually glad to see that there were people who would go see a film like this because I was afraid it might not have a whole lot of appeal. And of course, the film I'm referring to, Mr. Holmes, stars Ian McKellen, otherwise best known for his role perhaps as Gandalf in the Lord of the Rings series. But he portrays the aging Sherlock Holmes. And I have to say, it was masterfully well-done film. I've always liked Laura Linney as an actress, too, and she was just incredible in that film. And while films have always been a primary source of entertainment here in America especially, looking back before we had Netflix, before we even had television in our homes, people tuned into the radio at night. They would tune in and they would listen to the broadcasts, and I really enjoy the audio dramas of yesteryear. I mean, they're really a lot of fun to listen to. And as people know, from watching, for instance, videos of Jim Harold and I together on the Paranormal Report, right here in the Graylian Bunker in the studio, on the wall right behind the master console here, I have a vinyl copy of the recording of Orson Welles' broadcast of War of the Worlds, which aired on October 30th, 1938, which really was a game changer. It kind of relates to the discussion we're having about Mars right now, and it relates to a few other interesting things which we'll touch on a little later, that all have to do with presumed contact from aliens. It's very interesting how from time to time there is a sort of a multi-leveled subculture that involves actual science, science fiction, and then some wishy-washy kind of stuff in the middle that often involves things like hoaxes, or in the case of the War of the Worlds broadcast, it wasn't a hoax, but it was something that people nonetheless were unable to discern at that time whether this was a real broadcast of an invasion by Martians or not. Which in the history of broadcast, and of course also with regard to the concept of our eventual meeting with alien life, that broadcast, more perhaps than people realize, was truly a game changer.
In the 39th year of the 20th century came the Great Disillusionment. Near the end of October, business was better. The war scare was over. More men were back at work. Sales were picking up. On this particular evening, October 30th, Crosley Service estimated that 32 million people were listening in on radios.
At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The spectroscope indicates the gas to be hydrogen and moving toward the Earth with enormous velocity. Professor Pearson of the observatory at Princeton confirms Farrell's observation and describes the phenomenon as, quote, like a jet of blue flame shot from a gun, unquote. We now return you to the music of Ramon Raquello, playing for you in the Meridian Room of the Park Plaza Hotel, situated in downtown New York. Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Carl Phillips out at the Wilmot Farm, Grover's Mill, New Jersey. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the most terrifying thing I've ever witnessed. Wait a minute. Someone's crawling
someone
out
or
something. I can see turning out of that black hole through luminous discs. The eyes, it might be a face, might be almost... Good heavens, something wriggling out of the shadow like a gray snake. Now it's another one and another one and another one. They look like tentacles to me. Oh, yeah, I can see the thing's body. Now it's large, and large as a bear. It glistens like wet leather, but that face, ladies and gentlemen, it's indescribable. I can hardly force myself to keep looking at it. It's so awful. The eyes are black, and they gleam like a serpent. The mouth is that kind of V-shaped with saliva dripping from its rimless lips. It seems to, quiver and pulsate, and the monster or whatever it is can hardly move. It seems weighed down by possibly gravity or something. The thing's rising up now, and the crowd falls back. It seems plenty that... Most extraordinary experience, ladies and gentlemen. I can't find words. Well, I'll pull this microphone with me as I talk. I'll have to stop the description until I can take a new position. Hold on, will you, please? I'll be right back in a minute.
As I listen to those samples from the broadcast, and you can actually find the entire thing on YouTube now, I mean, it actually gives me chills. And the reason why is because I try to put myself in that mindset. You're at home. It's October 30th, 1938. The Columbia Broadcasting System maybe hasn't made it as clear as they should have, that this is just an audio drama. It was meant just to be entertainment. But as you can hear with the sound effects, it was so masterfully presented, and it was done so well, and so convincingly with all the sound effects and the sounds of people screaming and sirens and things going on in the background. You know, Howard Cook's script of that rendition that aired that evening of War of the Worlds, based on H.G. Wells' play, or rather his book, and granted, again, H.G. Wells, I think his version took place overseas. This was sort of retrofitted so that it made sense within the context of being on the U.S. mainland, which made it all the more believable. You're listening to this, you're at home, and I can, myself, listening to it after all these years, I can completely see why people who had never been exposed to something of that magnitude and presented in that way, why they actually believed a Martian invasion was occurring that night, which is really pretty fascinating. It got so out of hand that the following day, Orson Welles actually had to issue a public statement and an apology before the press. And as he's speaking to the press, you can hear in his voice and the answers that he gives that this was something that was completely unexpected. And this was really a game changer. It redefined the way that radio broadcast would be presented to the public forever after this point.
I am terribly shocked by the effect it's had. I do not believe that the method is original with me or peculiar to the Mercury Theater's presentation.
Do you think there ought to be a law against such enactments as we had last night or as a result of that?
I don't know what the legislation would be. I know that almost everybody in radio would do almost anything to avert the kind of thing that has happened, myself included, but I don't know what the legislation would be. We simply... radio is new, and we are learning about the effect it has on people. Learned a terrible lesson.
It really was quite fascinating, the way that this broadcast had had this incredible effect. I mean, there were farmers who were armed with pitchforks, and they were holed up in their barn ready to fight off these alien invaders. And in some situations, it may have been, in fact, much worse. That entire series of events is pretty well known to history. What may not be as well known are a few of the other incidents that have occurred over the years in which purported evidence of alien life has been revealed to the public over the airwaves. Now, another incident along these lines, although not one that was orchestrated on a large scale like the War of the Worlds broadcast on October 30th, 1938, another incident occurred on April 18th, 1975, which I would be willing to wager that most listeners probably are unaware of. A radio broadcast was underway, which was exploring mysteries of the Bermuda Triangle, some of which we looked at over the weekend on the Graylient X subscriber show. And one thing we didn't touch on that program, which I recommend, of course, if you're a subscriber, definitely go check that out. We look at a number of disappearances, at least one of which involved multiple aircraft that all vanished over the Bermuda Triangle. That was on Graylient X over the weekend, but one story we didn't get to was this program, this radio broadcast that was actually looking at theories behind disappearances in the Bermuda Triangle. And when they opened the phone lines, a very strange thing happened that evening.
Normally, all the phone lines were blanking. They're all solid. We had hundreds and hundreds of calls. And about 45 minutes into the broadcast, Alan Moore went to answer a call and hit the first line. It was blinking as though a call was coming in, and there indeed was no one there. There was no sound as though someone was on the phone. It was just dead.
Miami, WFTL, you're on the air.
He proceeded to go down five additional lines, and they were all in the same condition.
Hello, you're on the air.
Finally, on the sixth line, our caller started making a statement.
Hello.
There's one of you on the program who will understand what I am going to say. And every living thing on this planet has an aura. The area that you are discussing now is the aura of this planet. It is the communicative channel through which the Millennium Council governs this planet. Anyone going into the area when the communicative channel is open do not disappear, but they are in the timeless void. They are all perfectly alive and well. It is the only area through which the council can communicate with this planet.
Well, we lost someone here. Let's see who we have.
It's Monday morning. The morning DJ on the air offhandedly said, Have you heard our broadcast on the Bermuda Triangle? We had quite a good show last night. Something just in general reference to the show. Immediately after saying that, our switchboard lit up. People said, gee, I had a physical or mental reaction when that guy called last night on your show. That strange voice.
It was said at that time, in fact, that many of the listeners in that listening audience had called in and said, you know, we had almost an emotional reaction to this voice, which obviously sounded very alien. At least alien in the sense that he was not from the United States. Yes, in fact, the voice was British, which is usually a telltale sign that this is probably an Earthling, not an alien. But another incident that occurred that was perhaps even more strange and ominous actually occurred on November 26th, 1977, during which a broadcast interruption occurred through the Hannington transmitter of the Independent Broadcasting Authority in the United Kingdom. It was shortly after 5 p.m. local time. And as the news report was underway, suddenly a strange series of noises begins to be heard in the background, slowly overtaking the primary broadcast, and before long, listeners throughout the UK were suddenly hearing the voice of a man who claimed to be of a higher, perhaps alien, intelligence. Whether or not you buy that, I still maintain that this one was certainly one for the books.
The Rhodesian nationalist leader, Bishop Abel Muzorewa, has accepted Mr. Smith's offer to negotiate an internal settlement based on one man, one vote. But, he says, there are conditions. These include stopping the execution of all captured prisoners of war, allowing the world to stay close to negotiations, being arrested. In Australia, Mr. Kerry Packer's cricketers are still feeling about yesterday's High Court decision, which sticks to the ban on playing test matches.
This is the voice of Omar, representative of the Ashtar Galactic, speaking to you. For many years, you have seen us as knights and assailants. We speak to you now to serve them as we have done to your brothers and sisters all over this, your planet Earth. This is an order that we may share and fight to maintain as the planet passes into the new age of Aquarius. The new age can be a time of great peace and liberation for your race. But only your rulers are made aware of the forces that can overthrow their dominions.
Anyway, that gives you enough of an idea of what was occurring on that evening in 1977. Obvious, though, it is that the alien speaker here again uses a British accent, not necessarily to say that perhaps the last two calls we've examined here were the same individual, but this one nonetheless had an effect that was similar in some ways to that of the War of the Worlds broadcast that occurred decades beforehand in 1938. In fact, among a minority of those in the ufological community, it had remained in their minds a likelihood that this was no hoax, this was no hijacking, which is the official explanation. The Hannington UHF television transmitter had actually been one that was very susceptible at that time to hijacking. What they said had happened was that somebody had simply taken their own transmitter, moved it very close to the transmitter site located there at North Hampshire, and that in doing so, they were with relative ease able to overpower the signal that was being produced, and thus the hijacking occurred. That wasn't good enough, though, for a lot of those in the UFO community at the time. They believed it was an actual voice from an alien. And there was a letter that was even sent to the Times, which had questioned the entire scenario and the explanation. It asked, how can the International Broadcast Authority, or anyone else, be sure that the broadcast was a hoax? But again, it seems to me, as it did to those at the time of a more discerning nature, that the telltale sign here had been that this alien spoke with an English accent. Which kind of makes me wonder, would he have seemed as credible had he spoken with a Southern accent? You know, there's this stereotype that Southerners all sound stupid, right? And interestingly, studies carried out in the past have actually shown that people, especially who are not from England, when they hear a person with an English accent, they perceive that person as sounding more intelligent. This study actually was carried out with people who were actually giving presentations before an academic board, and they asked people who were listening, a group of participants in the study in question, to listen to those who were giving their presentations, and they gauged the credibility of those presentations which were given based on the accents. Of course, those who were being questioned weren't made aware of the fact that these accents had anything to do with whether or not the arguments presented by the participants would be credible sounding or not, but nonetheless, the questions were asked which presenters gave the most credible argument, and 10 to 1 those who presented and who had given their presentations, while of course administering the English accent, were found to be among the most credible and seemingly those who were the most authoritative. So interestingly, while in the UK, of course, we were able to say, you know, it seems highly unlikely that an alien's going to hijack our broadcast and just magically speak with an English accent, what we do find is that in the case with the Bermuda Triangle broadcast from April 1975, perhaps the emotional response that people called in and described having had when they heard this had more to do with the accent that was administered by the purported alien. Although, admittedly, if pressed on the subject, I could probably name at least one alien that comes to mind who spoke with a British accent.
You know, I really think you might.
See? Point in case. Anyway, it's kind of interesting how over the years we've had sort of a collective history of purported contact with extraterrestrials who call in to radio programs or perhaps just hijack television stations and their transmitters. That reminds me a little of another signal intrusion that occurred a few years later, this one on November 22nd, 1987, WGN-TV out of Chicago, then an independently owned station, was broadcasting the 9 o'clock news when this clown shows up, dressed up to look like Max Headroom. He's wearing sunglasses, he's jumping around and acting like a clown. Engineers at WGN then stopped the hijacking by switching frequencies, but it wasn't over yet. Later that night, it was around 11:15 p.m., a PBS member station, WTTW, which would have been Channel 11 back in the day. Viewers were tuning in, they were watching Doctor Who. The episode in question was The Horror of Fang Rock. And as the second hijacking occurred, first there was static, and then we see the clown jumping around dressed like Max Headroom. And for 90 seconds, a string of obscenities is broadcast before blacking out and then resuming The Horror of Fang Rock. Not only was it pretty bizarre, but it was fairly unprecedented, and, yes indeed, the man, the clown, Max Headroom, however you want to refer to him, he was never caught. No one knows exactly who that was or how it was carried out, but it was indeed one of those strange instances of a transmission disruption by a prankster, a merry prankster, a trickster, perhaps. Taking things in reverse order, since we've had so much on our minds tonight as it relates to radio broadcasts and, of course, the search for alien life and Martians that may be on the red planet. We're going to get to a little bit of news in the next segment when we come back here on the Graylian Report. Dark Heart of Appalachia, I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. In the last segment, of course, we were looking at strange broadcasts. Don't forget, if you're one of the podcast listeners, that you can tune into this program every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide, around the globe, via the internet, and our friends at the Global Radio Alliance, kgraradio.com. Of course, the podcast is available for free to listen to, on demand, anytime, anywhere. And for those who just can't get enough of the Graylian Report, you can sign up over at graylianreport.com/X to get weekly additional podcasts as well as monthly specials. Lots of good stuff to look forward to out there if you are a Graylian listener. Glad to have all of you here, whether or not you're a subscriber or perhaps an alien being from somewhere out there. If you are an alien, by the way, I'd love for you to call in sometime, or at very least send me an email. As a matter of fact, actually, speaking of emails, we do have one listener email I wanted to share this week in particular. As time allows, maybe we'll get to a couple more later. But Nate had written in response to the discussion we had a while back about the Fortean folk devils. He said, I've been wanting to write in with some kind of commentary for ages, and I wanted to say I love the 14 Folk Devils episode. I really dig the stories about those sorts of entities, and I wanted to share some info with you. I'm always disappointed that nobody ever includes the Norse god Odin on his list of folk devil-type characters, seeing as how he's more or less the undisputed king of them. And here's where Nate's reasoning is applied. He says, I know that's mostly due to the popular image of the Norse gods as extremely austere and warrior-like, and naturally Loki would get the most airtime on a list of tricksters. But he said, let me defend my position. Odin was said to wander the earth in a guise of a human, specifically in the guise of an old beggar, and he could generally be found making mischief. Seeing wandering, Odin was a terrible portent, usually of war and almost always of death. We all know he was said to command an army of dead warriors. He was also said to meddle in human affairs in order to start wars so that people would die and join that army. He was also said to lead something called the Wild Hunt. During midwinter, he would ride across the night sky with a gang of ghosts astride black horses, causing general havoc and unrest, and people who died of exposure trying to travel overnight through the snow were said to have been swept up in the Wild Hunt and carried to the underworld. Speaking of being carried to the underworld, Odin's horse was said to have 8 legs. Back in old-timey days, in just about every Indo-European culture from Ireland to Bangladesh, 8-legged horse was a euphemism for a funeral procession because there were usually 4 pallbearers. I describe this guy as being the king of 14 folk devils rather than just an example of one, because Odin is both king of the gods and the god of human kings in pagan Germanic religions, no lie. And also Odin and the Wild Hunter generally agreed upon to be the inspiration for most of our stories about Santa Claus, who I think fits the model pretty nicely, a wandering character of ambiguous but probably vast supernatural power who sneaks around and creeps on us while we're vulnerable. The fact that he does it just to give us candy and presents instead of obnoxious gas notwithstanding. I hope you found all that interesting. Thanks for all the great shows, and I can't wait to hear more in the future. Nate. I do appreciate your comments, by the way, Nate, and I'll also add to that that I believe that the original inspiration for Gandalf in Lord of the Rings, who's already come up in the conversation once in reference to Sir Ian McKellen a bit earlier in the program, but yes, Gandalf, I believe, was also partially inspired by that mythic representation of Odin and the wandering beggar form that he would often take. Moving along to some news, apparently it's not a great time to be a walrus, as authorities have launched a federal investigation into the deaths of 25 walruses found on a beach in northwest Alaska last week. According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they don't believe that these walruses died as a result of natural causes. Well, you think? Here's why they think this. The carcasses, nearly half of which were cubs, appear to have been shot, and some were beheaded. This, according to investigators, who suspect that they were probably poached for their ivory because some of the remains lacked tusks. Missing heads and tusks don't necessarily indicate illegal activity, according to a Fish and Wildlife spokesperson. However, the animals could have died in the ocean and washed ashore, they say. Federal regulations allow anyone to collect bones, teeth, and ivory of dead marine mammals found on beaches or land within a quarter mile of the ocean, though they must follow certain rules. Walrus skulls in particular, of course with their tusks attached, are considered to be collector's items. The ivory often is carved and made into jewelry. However, walrus killed only for the collection of ivory is considered wasteful, and head hunting, as it were, is illegal. Now, about 100 miles away from this location, near Point Lay, where about 35,000 walruses were hauled out yet again this year due to record low sea ice, an estimated 37 walruses were also found dead last week in this location. The Fish and Wildlife Service have said that they do not appear to have died as a result of foul play in that instance. We haven't had a chance to go out there and confirm whether they're from this year or from last year or identify the cause of death. But again, you know, we think about all the whale beachings, and maybe it isn't so simple as to say that, look, these things are missing their heads, some appear to have been shot, it's obvious that it was a poacher at work. Well, again, is it obvious? And what does appear to have been shot mean? I mean, was there a bullet hole? You know, were these animals found to have been killed with a firearm or not? That would be the question. But again, if it seems that there are things that are affecting marine wildlife, we've already seen the whale beachings. If walruses, for whatever reason, may be similarly affected, it could be that there were people who were cleaning up in the aftermath of nature's little mess. In other news, there's something that really managed to capture my attention, because I've talked about this a good bit lately. Black holes, and of course, Albert Einstein's groundbreaking theories of relativity, which essentially rewrote the Newtonian model of physics. which had been, up until that time, essentially the basis for all of our physical understanding of the nature of the world and the cosmos surrounding us. And the Daily Mail reports that nearly a century after Albert Einstein had proposed gravitational waves as part of his general theory of relativity, researchers have been perplexed by their apparent absence. That's right, we're still no closer to finding these. As a matter of fact, for the last 11 years, astronomers have been searching for evidence of these mysterious gravitational waves predicted by Einstein, which would be presumably ripples apparent in the very fabric of space-time. How would we observe these? Well, with high-precision telescopes. But we have not managed to find these so-called background rumbles created as galaxies merge. In fact, nothing has been found in the 11-year study. Scientists view the universe, again, as being made up of a fabric of space and time, and this corresponds to Einstein's general theory of relativity that he first published in 1916. Objects in the universe bend this fabric, and more massive objects bend it more, with gravitational waves being considered the ripples in this fabric. They can be produced, for instance, when black holes orbit each other or by the merging of galaxies. And when two galaxies merge, the black holes are drawn together and form an orbiting pair. At this point, Einstein's theory is expected to take hold, with the pair predicted to succumb to a death spiral sending ripples down, which are known as gravitational waves, through space-time. And although Einstein's general theory of relativity has been confirmed in every other respect, time dilation, everything, gravitational waves remain its only unconfirmed prediction. Now, for scientists, gravitational waves are significant because it is believed that they carry information allowing them to look back into the very beginnings of the universe. In particular, gravitational waves are thought to have been produced during the Big Bang. And so this is really kind of unsettling for scientists because it's long been expected, as with every other instance in the theory of relativity proposed by Einstein, that confirmation would eventually be found. We just haven't found that yet. There's been no strong evidence yet for the existence, circumstantial or otherwise, of gravitational waves. Now, the most recent research had been led by Dr. Ryan Shannon from the CSIRO and the International Center for Radio Astronomy Research. The high-precision Parkes telescope was used by Shannon and the team to monitor a set of millisecond pulsars. These small stars produced highly regular trains of radio pulses and essentially act like what you might call a clock in space. Now, the scientists recorded the arrival times of the pulsar signals to an accuracy of 10 billionths of a second. According to Einstein, what we expected was that a gravitational wave passing between Earth and a millisecond pulsar would squeeze and stretch space, changing the distance between them by about 33 feet. That's a tiny fraction of the pulsar's distance from Earth, but this would change the time that the pulsar's signals arrived on Earth. Of course, it would be very slight, that difference, but it would be a distance that should be measurable nonetheless. And so Shannon and the team of scientists working on this studied these pulsars for 11 years, and it was believed that this should have been plenty of time, long enough to reveal the presence of any gravitational waves, should there be any to be found. And there were no signs. We heard nothing, not even a whimper, Dr. Shannon said. It seems to be all quiet on the cosmic front, at least for the kind of waves we're looking for. And with or without Eric Maria Remarque quotes, or at very least puns based on them, we don't know right now whether we can confirm this aspect of Einstein's theory. It doesn't mean, again, that he has been proven wrong yet. It just means right now that maybe our understanding of the nature of the universe is somewhat incomplete, and further, that scientists suspect it's because black holes probably merge very fast. On Graylian X over the weekend, we talked about a supermassive black hole that has been found, which happens to be 30 times larger than it had been expected to be. We're learning all kinds of things about the universe right now, which defy everything that we thought we had known. And it's really rewriting what we think we know about the universe. And on that weekend program, I'll very briefly bring up a point that I made. I'd quoted Colonel John B. Alexander, Ph.D., in his book on UFOs, who had talked about attending a conference where a physicist stood up and said, "We already have unraveled 99% of everything that can be known, all knowledge that can be acquired in the universe, and that minuscule 1% that remains is largely comprised of just people like us getting together and debating back and forth over what already has been determined." And Alexander used this as an example of the kind of academic snobbery that we often find. Think about this. In a short 2-week period, we're now having to look at the nature of black holes, especially the supermassive ones that exist out there in the universe, as being fundamentally different from what we'd expected. We're still trying to understand aspects of Einstein's general theory of relativity, or at very least come to terms with why aspects of it are yet unproven. We have just discovered, of course, that there is flowing water on the surface of Mars, at least in certain times of the year, and that this may have vast implications in terms of the way that we look at life that may exist elsewhere in the universe. And you mean to tell me that there are actually scientists out there that say that we know, in all our infinite knowledge as humans, 99% or better in terms of all knowledge that can be acquired in the known universe? How arrogant can we be? How arrogant? My God, there are so many great mysteries that still elude us. We'll look at a few more as we continue after this on the Graylian Report. High mountains of Appalachia in a bunker beneath the surface world. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report, broadcasting globally around the world via the World Wide Web and KGRAradio.com. Glad to be with you as always. With our discussion in the last hour of alien life and mysteries of space-time and the cosmos behind us, I want to kind of narrow our focus and bring things back down to terra firma. Throughout the course of this hour, we're going to be examining some peculiar legends, especially as they relate to parts of the Pacific Northwest. And when we talk about legends and folklore, there's a reason why I seek to frame it within that context. Although I do feel that, whatever they may be, there are probably real-world implications that we're going to see that will begin to emerge over time. And yes, some of this has to do with what is, of course, popularly known today as Sasquatch. Some of it's even a little unsettling. But why I say that the folkloric examination is important, which I guess kind of mirrors that notion of the Fortean folk devil, is that when we look at history around the world and folk traditions and belief, what we actually find quite often is that there is a parallel to be found in virtually all cultures around the world as far as Sasquatch goes. You find virtually on every continent, maybe with the exception of Antarctica, some kind of a Bigfoot-like or Sasquatch-like creature. But there are interesting things that we see which begin to emerge in the folk legends and the mythology associated with these creatures. A lot of trends, a lot of consistencies, and I think that they say a lot more about the nature of humankind, and perhaps even interactions that we have had with other species of hominids throughout history. And I, for one, I'm not afraid to talk about Bigfoot, because I think that when we look throughout history at the evolution of humankind and our human ancestry, again, within just the last few weeks, new varieties of ancient hominid ancestors have been discovered. And we'll continue to discover new varieties. Some of them have been much larger and more robust than we, others smaller and far more arboreal. And we have noted over time, as a process of evolution and natural selection, that what eventually led to present humans over time has been represented by many different things that were somewhat like us and a lot more like things that we would call beasts or animals, our cousins and kindred amidst the animal kingdom. In other words, in different periods throughout history, there have been things which are very much like the purported Bigfoot or Sasquatch, which is presumed to exist today by some, but that in itself is really the only problem with the idea of the existence of Bigfoot. We can accept that at periods throughout history there had been things which in virtually every detail looked like, behaved like, and would have been by definition a large, hairy hominid, the likes of Sasquatch as we recognize it today. The problem is trying to say that that is indeed something that could or even does exist today. That is beyond the pale, beyond possibility for most, especially in academic circles. And there are a few, and have been over the years, bright minds within academic circles who have lent their knowledge and expertise to trying to unravel the Sasquatch mystery. Not all have gravitated so starkly towards skepticism. But whether or not, right now, in this moment, we have that debate about the physical existence of Bigfoot, what we can't deny are these myths and legends that extend well beyond the modern era where this debate about whether the thing could still exist began. There's some pretty interesting data to be found in those legends, as well as some interesting trends that begin to emerge. Some of them, as I've mentioned, are kind of unsettling, in truth. And I find that they mirror things, themes that we see in other areas as it relates to the study of the unexplained, namely that of UFO contact claims. But we'll get into that a little later, because before we delve into these Native American myths and legends and how they relate to modern interest in the subject of Sasquatch, one more news story which kind of presents an interesting bridge into that subject involves a newly discovered tablet. Hadn't been initially reported as being a newly discovered tablet, but now, according to one neurologist, he is not an archaeologist, he says that, but on his blog he featured a brilliantly well-written article about this, Osama S.M. Amin. His site, it's etc.ancient.eu, Mark Brady sent this along, but he wrote a blog post about what he calls the newly discovered Tablet 5 of the Epic of Gilgamesh. He notes, Osama that is, "I was taking photos in the main hall of the Suleymaniye Museum and came across a display case containing a small clay tablet. The description beside it said the tablet was part of the Epic of Gilgamesh and a fragment of Tablet 5. Immediately I thought it was a replica, as the description had been superficial. It didn't say that the tablet was genuine, that it was newly discovered, or even told about the many new pieces of information that it revealed." Now, after the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, a bit of a history he gives here, and the dramatic looting of Iraqi and other museums, the Suleymaniye Museum, directed by the Council of Ministers of Iraq, Kurdistan, started an initiative. They paid smugglers to intercept archaeological artifacts on their journey to other countries. No questions were asked about who was selling the piece or where it came from. The Suleymaniye Museum believed that this condition kept smugglers from selling their merchandise to other buyers, as they would have otherwise done so with ease and without any legal consequences. Osama continues, "In late 2011, the Suleymaniye Museum acquired a collection of clay tablets. The collection was composed of 80 to 90 tablets of different shapes, content, and sizes. All of these tablets were, to some degree, still covered with mud. Some were completely intact, while others were fragmented. The precise location of their excavation is unknown, but it is likely that they were illegally unearthed from what is known today as the southern part of Babylon." Now, while the seller negotiated the prices, Professor Farouk al-Rawai of the School of Oriental and African Studies in London rapidly examined each item in terms of its content and originality. He did find a few fakes, but the seller wanted a large sum of money for this particular tablet, which was apparently a portion of the Epic of Gilgamesh. He didn't know what it represented, he only knew it was relatively large. Still, this tablet captured the attention of Professor al-Rawai, and he skimmed the cuneiform inscriptions on it. He immediately intervened and told Mr. Hashim, his associate, to buy it. "Just give him what he wants," he said. "I'll tell you the rest later on." The final price that was paid was $800. So the professor cleaned the tablet very carefully. It was composed of three fragments, but amazingly, they had already been joined together. By whom? The excavators? The smugglers? Nobody seems to know. But soon enough, Dr. al-Rawai realized that this tablet was one of the tablets of the Epic of Gilgamesh. He informed his colleague, Professor Andrew R. George, about the discovery, and with the help of Mrs. Haro Talabani, the wife of former Iraqi President Mr. Jalal Talabani, Professor George received a funded visit to the Suleymaniye Museum. The two professors, Dr. George and Dr. Al-Rawai, resided in a guest house that had belonged to the General Directorate of Antiquities there at Sulaymaniyah. And apparently work began on reading and translating these cuneiform texts. And the museum's description beside the tablet said it dates back to Old Babylonian, probably between 2003 and 1595 BCE. And according to the article, Back to the Cedar Forest, the beginning and end of Tablet 5 of the Standard Babylonian Epic of Gilgamesh, published in June 2014, here's what we believe. The revised reconstruction of Tablet 5 yields text that is nearly 20 lines longer than previously known of the Epic of Gilgamesh. The obverse duplicates the Neo-Assyrian fragments, which means the epic tablet can be placed in order and used to fill in the gaps between them. It also shows the recension on Tablet 5 was in Babylonia as well as Assyria. And among other things, perhaps the most interesting piece of information is that this new source of information as presented by the tablet appears to give a continuation of the description of the cedar forest represented in the Epic of Gilgamesh, where Gilgamesh and Enkidu, his beast-like companion, saw apparently monkeys as part of the exotic and noisy fauna of the cedar forest. This was not mentioned in other versions of the epic. Also, Humbaba emerges, but not as a barbarian ogre, but as a foreign ruler entertained with exotic music at court in the manner of Babylonian kings. It is told in this Tablet 5 that the chatter of monkeys, the chorus of cicada, and the squawking of many kinds of birds formed a symphony or cacophony that daily entertained the forest guardian, Humbaba. The aftermath of Gilgamesh and Enkidu's slaying of Humbaba is now better preserved in this version, this tablet, and passages from it are consistent with other versions and confirm what was already known. For example, Enkidu had spent some time with Humbaba in his youth. Now, about Enkidu and Humbaba, as related in this tablet here. Enkidu, of course, was a beast-like man who, though initially had been an adversary of Gilgamesh, later became his greatest ally. And upon Enkidu's death, of course, we know that, according to the legend, Gilgamesh wept over his corpse for a number of days. And there have been some who have looked at this as perhaps one of the earliest, if not the earliest, written account of a wild man. Because Enkidu is essentially a Bigfoot. He is not something that is quite human. Enkidu is described as being a wild man, but obviously one who is capable of interacting with Gilgamesh. He is simply different from Gilgamesh, but manlike nonetheless. And we do see similar representations that appear in other ancient mythology and literature that appears over the years. Of course, the Epic of Beowulf in the Germanic tradition also represents Grendel as being something like a man, but not quite manlike, something very large. He was an outcast, a monstrous manlike outcast, which resided primarily away from civilization in the swamps and which would occasionally come down and raid villages and whatnot and wreak havoc, and hence Beowulf is tasked with attempting to slay Grendel. And throughout these various traditions in the ancient world, we do begin to see the underpinnings of mythology that would continue on into the present day, which associates within our midst some sort of a manlike and yet far more beastly than you or I, some sort of a creature that seems to bridge that gap between man and beast. In the modern day, of course, we would recognize this beast-man as being Sasquatch. This would be the general term we would attribute to that. Sasquatch or Bigfoot. I really kind of dislike that name, Bigfoot. I think it's absurd. I much prefer the term Sasquatch when we're discussing these things, which is a derivative of sorts taken from a number of different Native American terms for these creatures that was first, I believe, used in print by J.W. Burns, a government agent and a teacher who had lived among the Chehalis Indians. And starting in the 1920s and on up into the 1930s and 40s, he wrote for years about Bigfoot, well before it became this popular item in the media. And you see, it's funny because I've noted before on this program, there was an article a couple of years ago that appeared in the Pacific Standard, where a young woman had written an article talking about how believers in Bigfoot maintain that the creature exists despite its origins in a hoax. And this poor girl had no idea that the famous hoax in 1958, I believe, it was Bluff Creek, California. Ray Wallace had been behind this, and he had been working as part of a construction crew led by a gentleman by the name of Jerry Crew, who went out there one morning, finds these great big footprints all over the construction site, and it made headlines. And this is where that name Bigfoot came from. And people glossing over this perceive that as being the beginning of the Bigfoot legend, and they say that the entire thing can actually be explained away as a hoax based on the fact that we know that that was, of course, a hoaxed event right there, that Ray Wallace had been behind that, and he came clean and said that he'd done that years later. Funny that that made headlines, I believe, I guess, in the late 1990s, early 2000s, but it had been reported, I think, as far back as the 1980s, that there was another guy who claimed that he had actually loaned the prints, the castings that were made, that Ray Wallace used in order to perpetrate the hoax that he carried out there at Bluff Creek. This fellow actually had said that he had loaned the things to him and that he had been doing the same sort of thing as far back as the 1920s. A lot of people over the years have attempted to try and claim credit for Bigfoot hoaxes, and that does not necessarily disprove, nor does it lend credence, I think, to the argument for or against Sasquatch. I think it merely shows that this didn't begin in 1958 in Bluff Creek. But a lot of people gloss over that. They don't really care to look any deeper. Yet again, I point out here the importance of looking further back at what we would collectively refer to as Native American legends. And what we begin to find in some of those legends is indeed rather interesting. Now, I just want to say that in a number of different Native American groups, in a number of different legendary interpretations, a number of different names had been used for creatures like what we recognize as Bigfoot today. In a lot of those myths among these different tribes, the Bigfoot and his relatives were generally considered shy, sometimes benign or even protective, kind of these nature protectors. Although one thing that is consistent throughout the variety of legends is that often they were believed to kidnap a human wife. But it was always believed, generally, that these creatures didn't harm people and that they may even come to their aid from time to time, despite being recognized as being kidnappers, who would sometimes kidnap not only women, but sometimes infant children. Now, the Seattle Times carried an article in 1924 that was written shortly after an incident famously known as the Ape Canyon Incident. There were a group of miners who claimed that they were attacked and that their cabin was bombarded all night by stones that were presumably being thrown by these creatures that they heard howling outside the cabin. And this 1924 article sought to explain the incident at Ape Canyon as something which it reported at that time had been a lost race of American Indians, very large, very hairy. They were called the Sihatiks, and it's those beings whose existence, it was reported, virtually every Indian in the Northwest knew of. This Sihatik clan purportedly made their homes in caves or in the heart of the wilderness on Vancouver Island, and of course in the Olympic Range, in particular Mount St. Helens. They were believed to be close to around 8 feet tall in height. As with other Native traditions about Sasquatches kidnapping human wives, it was said that the Sihatiks did this as well. And the article reads, and I quote, "In that past generation, they stole many Indian women and Indian babies. They lived entirely in the mountains, coming down to the shores only when they wanted a change of diet. The Quinaults claim that they generally came once a year to the Quinault River about fall. The Clallams say that they favored the river area near Brennan or the Hood Canal. After having their fill of fresh salmon, they stole dried salmon from the Indian women, which presumably the creatures carried back into the mountains with them." We find some representations of these creatures that aren't as benign and friendly or as shy. But that article was very interesting to me because, again, what is reported is that among the various Northwestern Indian tribes, it was widely accepted that, yeah, there is a group, a lost group of gigantic Indians that live in the hills. They're like us. They even speak a language that's similar to ours, which I think various groups, including the Chehalis, had referred to as the Douglas dialect. But the legends went on to say that this group of Indians, they were hairy. They were like us, but they were large and they were hairy. One man had actually even claimed at the time that he had been taken into one of the cave dwellings by these creatures and he had conversed with them in this dialect for a period of time. Other legends told that the Sihatiks could be heard at night communicating with a loud howling noise that they used to call back and forth to one another. Now, for a moment, I want to break our pace in the chronological presentation of these Native American myths. And I want to come back around to a news report which was reported just in the last few days.
More on a story we first brought you last night, a mystery in Alert Bay. The people who live there say howls and screams are coming from the forest that borders their community, and the sound is like nothing they've ever heard before. Tonight, CTV's Gord Kerbis joins a renowned Sasquatch researcher who has traveled to the community to see and hear for himself.
And some wetlands in here.
John Vindernagel makes his way into a forested area on Cormorant Island, looking for a creature many say doesn't exist.
It comes back to this question that comes up in other places. Not why is it here? How could it be here? But there is evidence that it is here.
Well, the wildlife biologist is one of North America's best-known Sasquatch researchers. He's here because many on the island in the community of Alert Bay are seeing and hearing something they can't explain.
Vocalizations which we really can't attribute to wolves, coyotes, loons, owls. So it's in that area of possible Sasquatch. The soccer player saw this tall being.
Reports of sightings have been happening for more than a decade on the island, and the vocalizations heard in the evenings are increasing.
Fortunately, here, people have been recording them, just on cell phones for now, but at least recording them.
Vindernagel has been putting out his own recording equipment and spending hours talking with locals willing to share their encounters.
You know, the most I've heard is three, you know, it'll make this loud noise and then stop and do it again. But the thing that's happening now is what the dogs start answering it and it quits.
I think it's more conceivable than people think, and more conceivable than I used to think, that a Sasquatch could be here, could only be being observed once every several years, a fleeting glimpse, but which is leaving, well, I'm calling it a record of its presence.
That record, Vindernagel says, includes large footprints that have sometimes been photographed in different locations around the island. The creature has also been acknowledged in the First Nations culture for years as Zuniquas. He knows there are many skeptics, but he's confident one day the mystery will be solved.
Zuniquas, of course, being one of these traditional names given to these creatures. It is interesting, and you hear, of course, during that audio segment from the VancouverIsland.ctvnews.ca report, of the alleged howls, as they're often described. This is a consistent element which you find in modern, I think what Ivan Sanderson somewhat tongue-in-cheek referred to as Sasquatchery. But what we also see is that this is a consistent element within Native American legends about the Sasquatch. The difference between our modern interpretation, we of scientific and academic orientation, and those of yesteryear which accepted things in nature as they were for what they were, or what they were perceived as being. I think that the fundamental difference was that among the Native American Indians in the Northwest, it was widely accepted that there was a group of large, hairy, what they referred to as Indians, that existed. And I've spoken with a number of Native Americans over the years about these kind of things, and, you know, again, this is an attitude or an ideal that is reflected even today in the conversations I've shared. And J.W. Burns found this himself in the 1920s as he wrote about the subject. He noted that it was often somewhat offensive to the people if you tried to assert that this was something that was merely a myth, something in their folklore. They maintained that just like any other creature in nature, that the Siatic, or what other name you may ascribe to when describing Sasquatch, that these were real flesh-and-blood creatures. Sometimes, again, that they kind of played a role in the mythology that was much more like a protector. But these were real flesh-and-blood creatures, and that these things sometimes interacted with humankind. And in certain legends, they were described as being variously protectors, sometimes antagonists, sometimes kidnappers, sometimes even cannibals. For instance, among the traditions of the Kuka Dikati band of the Paiute Indians near Mono Lake, California, there's a creature that was believed to exist. It went by the name Pahizoho. And this was, again, purportedly an instance of the Sasquatch in Native American folklore. It was believed that the Pahizoho inhabited the Sierra Nevada mountain ranges. And in their legends, traditionally, the Paiute tried to avoid contact with the Pahizoho. And it was believed sometimes that children who wandered far enough from the Paiute encampments might even be abducted by those creatures, particularly one of three varieties, those with red hair. The legends about red-headed giants in the Paiute traditions are pretty well known. In fact, one obvious parallel that can be drawn here are the stories about Lovelock Cave in Nevada, where among Paiute traditions there, it is believed that the Lovelock Cave had been the site where the Pahi Zoho had been chased. Into this cave, there were large, red-headed cannibal giants and natural enemies of the Paiutes. And after a battle, the Pahi Zoho rushed into the cave, at the mouth of which the Paiute built a large fire, and it essentially smoked out the entire cave, and it killed those Pahi Zoho which were within the cave. Interestingly, around 1911, perhaps actually officially acknowledged in 1912, there was a guano mining operation that took place in the Lovelock Cave. And initially, when the discovery of large mummies were found, it wasn't reported to anthropologists by the miners. It was about a year after the fact when they were finally able to get in there. A lot of the mummies and the other artifacts found in the cave were destroyed. There's no convincing evidence that the quote-unquote giant bodies that were found in Lovelock Cave were any taller than maybe 6 feet. There are certain artifacts, including sandals and things, footwear and other kinds of things, pieces of clothing that suggest some large people may have worn them. But even at 6 or 6.5 feet, that's a fairly tall person, not anomalously large. And, in telling this story and drawing the distinction between the legends of the giants and the actual size of the giants, this is what, in years past, I've actually been criticized for, because I went on Coast to Coast AM, and I talked about this with guest host Richard Sirrett, and I said, you know, we could have 6-foot-tall, 7-foot-tall, 8-foot-tall mummies or skeletons found, and none of this would present us with proof of a lost race of giants, the likes of which many have speculated to exist over the years in fringe archaeology circles, or the likes of which were described in the various Native American legends as previously discussed here. I said that really the thing is that Robert Wadlow, at 8'11" tall, is the tallest man on record known to have ever existed. We would need not one, we would need several skeletons taller than that, which is what I call the Wadlow test, in order to have something that seems anomalous. But even then, I don't know that that would necessarily qualify. That would merely mean that we have a skeleton taller than Wadlow. And we know that there are various different forms of pituitary gland or other kind of growth hormone disorders which can lead to gigantism like this, acromegaly being the actual clinical term for it. Well, certain Coast to Coast listeners were infuriated, and I got angry emails. You're just part of the cover-up. You know, you're probably working for the Smithsonian. You're just trying to obfuscate the actual truth from us here. Jason Colavito, of course, went on his blog and laughed about it and said, I think it's funny that Mike is downgrading the giants, when in fact, actually, I'm saying essentially what I've tried to say all along, that there are instances where large skeletons have been found, but they don't seem to indicate evidence of a lost race of giants. You know, it's funny because what you end up finding in the long run is that people hear what they want to hear, no matter what you actually try to say. And I've tried to maintain a credible, clear, concise, and rational, a skeptical attitude toward all of this. But what we know is that, you know, even J.W. Burns had talked about the large skeletons found in various caves and whatnot. And at one time, he had thought that maybe these were evidence of the Pahi Zoho, or of the Siatik, or the Sasquatch as we know them today. Later in life, J.W. Burns felt that that wasn't necessarily so likely the case. But if we could ever find one instance where there were a single archaeological discovery, a mound is excavated, and all of a sudden there are, you know, I mean, not just one among many smaller skeletons, but I mean an entire group of 8 or 9 foot tall skeletons all buried together, that would be interesting, because it would seem to indicate that this isn't just necessarily a large person who was buried. This would seem to indicate perhaps a group of people who were a little larger than average. To my knowledge, there isn't any record of such a burial site found, and I've often been told by people, oh, if you just look online, you can find all day, every day, and twice on Sundays, that kind of information. Well, I've looked, you know, there isn't a lot of information that substantiates those kind of archaeological finds. There are certainly large skeletons that have been found, and there are examples of this that are still kept in the off-site storage facility by the Smithsonian, which are existent in their accession card catalog. We've talked about that even recently in response to one of the listener emails on this program. And taking it for what it is, we do know that there were large humans, and their remains have been found. I don't know that you can say that that is evidence of these giant Indians that we find evidence of in the myths and legends. So sticking with the myths and legends, nonetheless, we still find a lot of interesting things worthy of consideration. Now, coming back to the Pahi Zoho, and I want to actually be clear that that's one term that is used among the Paiute, but actually, in relation to the red-headed giants that were chased into Lovelock Cave, that band of the Paiute actually used a different name, the Sitaka, for these red-headed giants. It had been the Kukadikati of California that had referred to them as the Pahizoho. And one particular legend among that band of the Paiute tells of, coming back to this idea of the Sasquatch kidnappings, it tells a very interesting legend about a woman who strayed a little too far from the group that she had been out gathering berries with. Her story is indeed a strange one, and it's not unlike a number of stories which, when we come back from this break, we will examine, some of which begin to spill over from the realm of and the period of Native American folklore into the modern era. We'll look at those when we come back here on the Graylian Report. Mountains of Appalachia. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report. As we continue our examination of Native American folklore as it pertains to the mythical Sasquatch, many would maintain there's more here than just a myth. And so often, I think that the debate and the discussion over the legitimate existence of a creature like Bigfoot overshadows the history that is represented in Native American folklore about this creature. I think it's important sometimes to look at that folklore, put our folklorist cap on. Let's put aside the debate about whether or not these things exist. Let's look at what these traditions show us. Let's see if there are elements, correlations, consistencies that we begin to notice that stick out, that emerge, that seem to be consistent or just evidence of something. That doesn't necessarily prove Bigfoot, but nonetheless we can maybe learn something about human behavior, human attitudes, and belief in that archetypal wild man. It's interesting to me that so many cultures around the world since the beginning of time, the earliest and most ancient epics available to us, dating back to the ancient Mesopotamia and the like, even describe interactions between humans and, you know, creatures or people which are more like a mix between a man and a beast than merely a man. So, returning to the Paiute Indian, specifically the Kukatikati legends, one tells of a young woman who was abducted by one of these creatures that they called the Pahizoho. She'd been out with a group of fellow tribeswomen, and as she was picking berries, she moved toward the edge of the forest when she said suddenly from behind a tree a Pahizoho appeared and carried her away. Now, during the interim, during the period while she was missing, according to the legend, a search party had been organized, and as this group ascended into the Sierras in search of the young woman, they came across her. She was very frightened. She came running out of the forest. She was hysterical and making gestures back toward the forest. The story she told was that she had been picking these berries when this Pahizoho came out from behind a tree and grabbed her. She described him as being covered in reddish hair, and that when he grabbed her, she screamed and screamed. He carried her off, and she thought for sure he was going to eat her, but instead, rather than eating her, he carried her into the bushes, and as she told, he forced himself upon her. Now, the young woman in the story told that this Pahizoho smelled so bad that it made her sick, and that, of course, as the act was being carried out, it was extremely painful for her. She said that in the entire time she was kept with the creature, it never spoke, it merely grunted. Now, she again was afraid that after this creature had had his way with her, that she would then be eaten. But that didn't happen. She said that the creature clutched her close to him, and held her against his body as he drifted off and went to sleep. Well, she was too terrified to sleep herself, and in fact was too terrified to move, fearing that this Pahizoho was going to kill her. And so she lay there virtually all night, unable to sleep, not only due to the fright, but also the horrible smell of the creature, which she likened to rotting meat. And of course this thing snorted and grunted and snored very loudly, keeping her awake. Well, as dawn approached, she said as the creature moved about that his grip on her loosened somewhat and that she finally made a dash. She leaped up and ran. And it was shortly after that, as she fled down the side of the mountain, that she came across the searchers who found her. But that wouldn't be the end of the story. It gets stranger. Because sometime after her strange affair with the Pahizoho that kidnapped her for an evening, it was said, according to this legend, that the young woman began to show signs of pregnancy. The people stayed clear of her, except her friends and family. 9 months followed, and soon she had a son. He was a big red-headed baby boy, and he also was very hairy. The people were scared at first, and some of the men wanted to kill the infant, but the girl's mother prevented them. Later, the people accepted him into the group, for he was a good hunter, and he had an uncanny ability of sight and smell, which was very strong. And he eventually grew up and married, and his children came out a little more normal-looking than he, but every now and then one of his descendants would have a little more hair than others. Many of his descendants, it was said, are now scattered in many of the Paiute tribes in California and Nevada. Now, these legends are pretty consistent, that the native women were from time to time kidnapped by these Pahizoho, or these Siatiks, whatever you want to call them. And that occasionally offspring actually emerged as a result of these couplings. Now, I want to go to Ivan T. Sanderson, who in his book, Abominable Snowmen, Legend Come to Life, he told another interesting legend as related to the aforementioned J.W. Burns. And the passage from Sanderson's book reads as follows. Mr. J.W. Burns, now retired and living in San Francisco, who had devoted a lifetime to the study of this business, that is, Sasquatchery, unearthed an old Amerindian woman from Port Douglas at the head of Harrison Lake who alleged and brought some seconders to confirm that she had been kidnapped by one of these creatures in the year 1871. She was kept by it for a year, but finally returned by it to her tribal homestead because, quote, she aggravated it so much. Later, she would actually say that this creature had treated her with every consideration. Now, this old lady died in 1940 at the age of 86. When abducted, she said she was 17 years old, and she stated that she was forced to swim the Harrison River by the creature and then carried the rest of the way by him to a rock shelter where its aged parents had dwelt. Now, this account comes from Mr. Burns, who had for years enjoyed the confidence of this retiring woman. It was embellished in various ways by others over the years who told the story, which included stories that the woman had had rosin plastered over her eyes by the creature, or that she had become pregnant by it, or that she had subsequently given birth to a half-breed that was either her stillborn, or which died shortly after birth, or is still hidden by her people from the eyes of the white man. In fact, Sanderson reports, she never said any of those things to Mr. Burns, but nonetheless adhered to her straightforward story till her death. In other words, there was no pregnancy. You know, there was no pine sap. This is another thing that you do find in a lot of the legends about kidnapping, that the creatures would take pine sap and smear it over the eyes of these Native American women so that they couldn't see where they were being taken. None of those aspects, according to this woman, were true, but she maintained throughout her life that, yes, she had lived with one of the creatures and that she had been carried away by it. Now, it's indeed a very strange story, but I think maybe I could find one that's a little weirder, if you can imagine such. And at this point, our narrative is going to kind of drift over from even the what some researchers over the years have considered seemingly credible stories told by Native American women. If we were to nonetheless look at those as part of the indigenous American folklore, at this point, the stories begin to carry over beyond the realm of purely the indigenous Americans. And we start hearing stories that, although they're being related outside the cultural context of Native American native tribes, they nonetheless bear a lot of these peculiar characteristics, which are essentially this: abduction and attempts at interbreeding. In a minority of cases, I'll go ahead and admit as well, it is implied that some have felt that these creatures might be opportunistic in their feeding habits and might even try to consume humans that they've abducted, but this is not a consistent narrative throughout these legends, like the abduction and the apparently sexual component that does remain fairly prevalent. Now, this next story, which I said is going to do you even better than this last one, was related by a man named John Lewis. It was sent to the late Bobby Short, who is a researcher who for years maintained the website Bigfoot Encounters. After her death, there were some interesting things found about her. Not anything bad, necessarily, but apparently she had used a certain pseudonymic components with her online identity for various reasons. However, that's a bit beside the point. The story that John Lewis shared with her was as follows. He had said that at one point, his grandfather, who had worked as a railroad employee for a number of years in British Columbia, had told a very strange story, and that his daughter, which would have been John Lewis's mother, and her sisters, had ridiculed him for this story, and you'll see why here in a moment. The story was that Grandpa, Mr. Lewis said, was working for the Southern Pacific Railroad and building track in the Northern California-Oregon border area in the early 1900s. Now, Lewis said, I don't know the year, but during this work project, he was dispatched to work on a line camp in the woods. They had a base camp that the work crew worked from, and each week the work crews would split into two-man teams that would work an area clearing logs and ground, and at the end of 1 week, they would go back to the base camp to check in and replenish their supplies, and then they'd set out after the weekend for another week in the woods. Now, during this time, one of the two-man teams came back to base camp, and there was only one man. They were told that the other man had just disappeared. The group at the base camp apparently gave a brief search, but they had no luck. Now, the next week, the crews went on out in their two-man crews and continued to work on the railroad line clearing. A few weeks later, and his grandfather had said he wasn't sure exactly how long this had been, but a group of the railroad workers came upon the missing man, and this is the condition in which he was described. He was naked, he was hysterical, or crazed, and apparently had died soon after he was found. But before dying, what he told the other men was that he had been abducted by a female ape that kept him in a large open pit. Now, during the time that he was in the pit, the man told of being forced to have sexual contact with the ape many times, and said that the ape kept him in the hole or pit by licking his hands and feet to the point that they were raw, so that he was unable to escape from the pit. Apparently, my grandfather, Lewis says, saw the man's hands and feet and said that indeed they were completely raw. Now, if that isn't a weird story for you, as I had promised you it would be, then I don't know what to tell you. As I'd mentioned, Mr. Lewis's mother and siblings had criticized their grandfather, not because the story seemed unbelievable, but simply because, as they had been taught in school, no apes exist in North America. But there are a lot of stories like these. Again, probably one of the more famous among them being the Albert Ostman story from 1924. It's well known, but again, just to briefly recap it here, in 1924, Ostman had taken a short vacation from his work with a logging operation. He decided to go out and try his hand at prospecting and had heard about a lost gold mine up near Toba Inlet in western British Columbia. So he went up there on this vacation. He hired a local Indian guide when he visited the town of Lund, and he had this gentleman escort him to the mouth of the inlet by boat. This guide had told Ostman at that point that you needed to be careful. Ostman, that is, when he went up there in those mountains. He'd said that there was another guy who had come to visit Lund sometime before. He was a heavy drinker, and he never worked. They said that this guy would go off into the woods for days at a time and would come back and always have money, and presumably he had found one of these lost gold mines, many of which were said to exist up there around Toba Inlet. Well, the story goes that after one of his visits into the forest, this man never returned, and so the locals had all presumed, you know, he was probably killed by a Sasquatch. That's probably what happened. Now, Ostman, of course, said, I didn't believe in these stories of the mountain giants, and so he just put that aside. Well, the guide carried him to an initial camping spot there at the mouth of the inlet, and they made arrangements to meet there again when Ostman returned on a certain date, and he headed on up into the mountains. And eventually he found a little stream flowing between two cypress trees growing right by a rock wall. He loved this campsite, and it was a good distance up into the mountains after a few days hiking. So he made this his permanent camp. And over the course of several nights, he had described that he had had belongings that went missing from his campsite. He thought that there was a porcupine or something along those lines that was getting into his groceries and whatnot that he brought up the mountain with him. So he took a number of things, including some coffee and a few items of canned food, his tobacco, and also his rifle. He took his shoes off, but put them down in his sleeping bag with everything else, and wore his clothes, and he decided, I'm going to stay up all night, keep my rifle here with me, and anything that I don't want pilfered, and I'm going to wait and see whatever it is coming into the campsite, I'm going to get it. He had hoped it was a porcupine. He wanted to make porcupine stew. But apparently sleep eventually overtook Albert Osman. He says that later that night, he was awakened by something carrying him off. He said he was down inside the sleeping bag, and it was being carried as though it were a large sack with him in it. And he was carried in this way for hours and hours and hours. And the long story short goes that he was eventually dumped out in the presence of four large creatures, the largest being an, quote-unquote, old man, as he called it, that he believed had carried him there. And he was kept unable to leave by these creatures for several days. He wasn't unharmed. At one point, even the young male, there was a large male, a young female, which was the youngest of them all, and then an old woman, which was apparently the mother, who he described as being very meek and very shy, didn't want to come out and have a whole lot to do with Albert Osman. The young kids, as they were a little more friendly. The old man didn't have much to do with Albert either, but he said that they did communicate with this strange chattering and that they talked all night after they brought him back there. Now, he wasn't allowed to leave, but he wasn't hurt either. He was, in fact, on one occasion, the young male brought what were called sweet grass by Osman that he watched the young male pick in this valley where he was being kept. He was actually brought some of these roots and allowed to have these to eat, along with whatever food Osman had brought with him. And he said, obviously, they weren't trying to hurt me, but they weren't going to let me leave. He said it was pretty clear to me why I was here. Osman believed that the old man had brought him there to be a mate for the daughter. Now, there have been other researchers, and I believe I remember Peter Byrne, the former big game hunter turned Bigfoot researcher, who over the course of his life had raised a lot of money, I think somewhere in the neighborhood of like $5 million from various investors, Tom Slick, the oil man, and others, who had put money behind Bigfoot research. I don't think that Peter Byrne believed that that was necessarily the case, that, again, that Albert Osman had been brought to be a mate for the child. He said that was probably in Albert's imagination. But there are similar stories where people have been kidnapped and taken up into the woods. Just 4 years later, a similar incident involving a man named Mutilot Harry. He was a Native American man himself and a trapper. He claimed that he had been kidnapped and that while he was in his campsite wearing only his underwear, he was carried off into the mountains by a large male Sasquatch. He was taken to the encampment. He said that there were about 20 of the things in this particular camp and that they were fascinated by his long underwear and that they'd come up and they'd grab his clothing and pull on it because they couldn't seem to understand that that wasn't his skin. But Harry was terrified because he said that there were bones that were piled around in different parts of this Sasquatch camp, and he presumed that they had brought him there to eat him. And he, like Osman, made a run for it and managed to escape. And after that, when he finally got back to civilization, Mutilot Harry would never go back in the forest, ever. So there are a lot of these strange stories that come about over the years that seem to indicate maybe there's something to all this. At least as far as the consistency in these reports of these Bigfoot kidnapping people. The reports do carry over into the present day. And although in recent years there don't appear to be many credible reports where people have come back and said, my God, I just spent a weekend in the woods with a Bigfoot. Some have alleged that although it is not stated explicitly, it is implied within the works of researcher David Pilates, who has written the books, the Missing 411 series. Some feel that it is implied that there are certain cases in the Missing 411 books that seem to suggest that there is a kidnapper, that there is someone or something behind some of the kidnappings. Pilates talks about a lot of trends and a lot of things, and he asks his readers to, you know, think outside the box when it comes to what the sources of these kidnappings and disappearances might be. And he never explicitly states what that is, but he does cite certain UFO research, MUFON reports and things along those lines. And he also, I'll point out, has a past, quite a history of involvement with Bigfoot research. In fact, the first time I ever saw David Pilates in person, he was giving a lecture on Bigfoot, and I got to talk with him for a few minutes shortly after that. The second time I saw him was in Maryland at the Fort Fest, where he gave a lecture on the missing 411 thing. And he began that lecture by saying, anything you've ever heard me say about Bigfoot, leave that at the door. We're going to look at something completely different and unrelated here. Which they did. But in my mind, it seems likely, although he doesn't say that, and I totally understand, we've said this before on the show, I understand why David Pilates would leave Bigfoot out of the missing 411 narrative. Unfortunately, you are castigated if you talk about this. And for similar reasons, one might even assert, I find it safer, to talk about this in a folkloric context, not to try and dismiss or to simply ignore the idea that people, even up until the present day, continue to report things very similar to these Native American legends. It's not to overlook or to ignore those things, but it is to acknowledge, rather, as I see that many in the media fail to do, even within the current existing debate about the existence of Bigfoot, often the legends that span hundreds of years are completely ignored in this narrative. And I think it's important to examine the folklore without worrying about trying to make a case for or against the existence of Bigfoot. See, in the past, I've been rather critical of the Patterson-Gimlin film, and largely, as I've said, because if it hasn't been successful in convincing people, don't present that as evidence. If we need evidence of Bigfoot, which we do, we don't have good, hard physical proof, and that's incredible if there's really anything to the multitude of reports that exist. But nonetheless, the multitude of reports are very difficult, after you've immersed yourself in the literature, to ignore. So I wonder sometimes, what is this? Is it something sociological or cultural? And something that has had an archetypal component that has existed with us since the dawn of humanity, as evidenced by ancient traditions and ancient epic tales like Gilgamesh and Beowulf. You know, why is the consistent story of the man-beast so consistent? Why does it seem to remain ever-present? Why do we have the Woodwoses that appear in the British folklore? You know, why do we have the lycanthropes and the werewolves and things like that? Again, man-beasts that appear in other countries throughout Europe. You know, when we go back to the King's Record, that ancient medieval script from Norway, we hear in that section on the wonders of Ireland the description of a strange creature that was found. They didn't know what kind of a creature it was because in all ways it resembled a man, but it was covered in hair and had a mane-like hair that actually went down the course of its back, kind of like a horse. You know, descriptions of creatures remarkably similar to what we would call Bigfoot are present throughout the various literature, the myths, the traditions, the folklore, the epics. I mean, they are everywhere we look, essentially. And so that is what I'm trying to say. Again, we can argue all day about the existence of Bigfoot in the modern era, but people don't want to look at the ancient history and the way that throughout our ancient history, this archetype, whatever the meaning behind that prevalence is undeniable. That, to me, is absolutely fascinating. And so this abduction motif, one final thing I'll say about that is that, again, here we have apparent non-human entities, which in cultural traditions from around the world, and especially in the Northwestern American Indian folklore, we have these creatures that abduct people, and often for purposes of what appears to be interbreeding with them. We can't deny that that scenario sounds extremely familiar. Think about it. Think about that. Abduction by non-human entities that are attempting to hybridize with humans. This is something that is ever-present in virtually all interpretations of the unexplained. We see it in UFO research just as well. We see it in the fairy folklore of the British Isles. But especially in the UFO lore, the idea of the UFO occupants occasionally coming down and abducting people and performing bizarre sexual experiments on them, that became a prevalent motif throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s, but you know, going back to the 1960s, so a lot of those early reports of abduction were a lot more explicit. They involved less instrumentation and weird experiments being done, and more overt actual contact. Going even further back into the 1950s, Antonio Villa-Boas, what did he claim? He said that an aircraft lands, and that he was taken aboard this thing, slathered in some sort of a strange substance, and that a beautiful, blonde-haired, large-eyed female appeared, and that the two of them, well, engaged in the act together. The sexual theme is a lot more prevalent in those early contact reports, and over the years it kind of transmogrifies and becomes a more clinical kind of an environment. The alien beings themselves less human-like and becoming more and more sterile. And now today, very little is said of the alien abduction phenomena. That's not to say that there aren't still people who claim that they've had those experiences, and some of them perhaps credible. But again, when we look at those experiences, the more credible alleged abductions like that of Travis Walton, in large part the creatures that are described look very much like humans. I mean, that has to be taken into consideration. I don't think that that necessarily removes the possibility that there are people who find themselves in unique circumstances that seem to involve unexplainable or unconventional aerial phenomena. But I again wonder if what we are seeing is what it appears to be. In other words, how do we prove this is something alien? If it looks like a duck, if it floats, is it made of wood? Remember Monty Python? You know, again, if the aliens that are described look like people, I think that we can look at some of the UFO cases and consider whether or not there is actually a very human component to this. As Dr. Frank Drake had actually said a number of decades ago, he'd said that after an exhaustive study of UFO reports and UFO literature, he said that he seemed to think there was something going on, but that it seemed far more likely that this was probably something that was originating from Earth. And back to the idea of Sasquatch, it is interesting that in folkloric traditions, Jacques Vallée, of course, having made these comparisons between fairy folklore and UFOs, we see the same thing as prevalent in the legends about Sasquatch. And interestingly, when we think about ancient history of humankind, and of course, you know, the in ancient times, modern humans and their interactions as they migrated into Europe with Neanderthal, the Neanderthal weren't killed out. It's believed that they were probably absorbed through interbreeding with modern humans, and that one group of people essentially over time overtook another. What if, strange though it may sound, unsettling though it may be for some, what if what we are looking at in the ancient world is very similar to those kinds of things that we see reflected in Native American folklore, like a lot of these kinds of things tend to be? Again, I've made that argument at the outset that really Bigfoot, as it's called today, however absurd that name may be, differs very little from various instances in the history of hominids that have walked this earth. And as we see with the interactions that I've described between Neanderthal and early humans, there are a lot of instances where, rather than just being killed out or wiped out or dying out for other reasons, perhaps actually the interactions between these two groups leads to the absorption. And of course, genetic science tells us that many of us alive today actually carry Neanderthal DNA for this very reason. Maybe it's not impossible that these kind of interactions have occurred more recently, but for the time being, at very least, the analysis of the folklore may bear fruit in some capacity nonetheless. That's going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the program. On behalf of all of us here at Graylin International Studios, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, John Anderson, Dick Oakley, Matthew Oakley, Rayson Robert Hobbs, Jeremy London, and yours truly, I remain Micah Hanks here in the high mountains of Appalachia. And until next time, my friends, stay strange. We'll catch you next week here on the Graylin Report.
Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylin Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website graylinreport.com.